Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everybody, we've got a great one today, you know, for a change, and I really mean it this time. Heather McGee, my all-time favorite guest, now on for her third time. You know, when I guest hosted The Daily Show, I asked Heather to be one of my guests, and she knocked it out of the park, as she always does, and that show was the highest rated by any of their guest hosts, not because of Heather. It was me. You know, when I first got to the Senate, the Great Recession had just begun, and the housing market, as you know, collapsed, hurting a lot of people. And Heather was the head of a group working on economic disparity issues. And I had a piece of legislation that group, Demos, got behind, trying to address how the credit rating agencies had given these AAA ratings to junk. And Demos and Heather and I started working on it together. So we got to know each other back then. And those of you who have listened to Heather's previous conversations here know that she has written one of the most insightful books in explicating the wealth gap between whites and blacks in this country. The average black family led by a college graduate has less net wealth than the average white family led by a high school dropout. The book, The Sum of Us, a runaway New York Times bestseller. The title comes from the premise that the whites at the top have always told whites at the bottom that whatever helps black people economically hurts them. And that, of course, turns out not to be true. So the title, The Sum of Us, echoes the theme of one of my heroes, Paul Wellstone, who said, "We all do better when we all do better." Anyway, now The Sum of Us has been adapted, Heather adapted it, for middle school students, which I find very exciting. And of course, Heather has been learning quite a bit about American schools now and has a lot of really important thoughts on book banning. The Sum of Us hasn't been banned. At least not that I know of. But this is happening all over the country, and it's pernicious, this book banning. Anyway, if you've heard Heather here before, I know you'll want to listen, and if you haven't, this will be a real treat for you. Meanwhile, Republicans seem to be doubling down on abortion. Florida passed a law outlawing abortions after 6 weeks of conception. Of course, sometimes women don't know they're pregnant at 6 weeks, a bit of a problem, but, you know, who cares? That, of course, is Ron DeSantis running for the Republican nomination. Most Republicans, I guess, are anti-choice, so that's a logical play if you're trying to get the Republican nomination. Now, it used to be a winner for Republicans in general elections because it was a single issue for a sizable number of Republicans, but not for pro-choice Democrats, because pro-choice Democrats just always assumed that Roe would never be overturned. Then we had Dobbs. So now it is a single issue vote for pro-choice Democrats, women and men, maybe more women, but for lots of young women and men, it's a big, big issue. And it's a big issue now for pro-choice Republicans. This is a DeSantis play for the Republican nomination. He's lost ground to Trump lately. Before the indictment, DeSantis was within 8 points of Trump, but now he trails by 28. That's mainly the indictment, I think, which a lot of Republicans consider kind of rinky-dink. And also, DeSantis has made a couple of mistakes, calling the war in Ukraine a territorial dispute that is not a top security interest for the United States. Trump is really no better on Ukraine. He says all you have to do is get Zelensky and Putin in a room and work it out. But mainly Republicans, especially, of course, the MAGA Republicans, have rallied around Trump. Now, this is what interests me. On last week's podcast with Harry Lipman, we went through the panoply of possible indictments against Trump, and there's a lot. The Mar-a-Lago documents, that's gotten very bad for Trump. Georgia, January 6th, of course. Now the $200 million plus that he raised by mail from supporters to help him prove that the election was stolen. It looks like an indictment maybe coming there. There's the E. Jean Carroll rape trial coming soon. Will they stick with Trump through all of these? Some will, but how many? I'm not the only one looking at this and thinking this way. Chris Christie, I'm sure. Tim Scott has announced an exploratory committee. I see a bigger field than we thought a while ago, which means this could be a very interesting cycle. Fox News is hosting the first debate. That'll be a few months after they get dragged through the mud in the Dominion trial. I spoke with Jeremy Peters from the New York Times the other day, and he'll be joining us in a couple weeks to report on that trial. Anyway, Fox is insisting that the candidates in the debate pledge to support the Republican nominee, which you'll remember Trump didn't do in 2016. Not only won't he make a pledge, this is my prediction, if Trump isn't the nominee, he will run as the third party. I guarantee it. You can imagine how pissed he will be at whoever does get the nomination. Can you imagine how much he will hate whoever the Republican nominee would be who beat him? I wish this wasn't so interesting, and by that I mean ugly and scary, but it is. Anyway, here's something that's neither of those things, Heather McGee. Listen to Heather and you'll feel better. Because she talks about difficult subjects, but it's so rational and brilliant and knowledgeable and passionate that you'll feel better about everything. Now, we recorded this a couple weeks ago. You know, in between time, we had the Mishegoss in Israel heat up and then the Trump indictment. So we did shows on those. So we start with the banking crisis, one of Heather's areas of expertise, and then on to the rest of our discussion. This is truly a great one, you know, for a change. The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way, and that's with Babbel. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's convenient courses have helped me learn real-life conversation in German. For example, let's say you wanted to order soup with your dinner. Die Suppe würde mir auch gefallen. That means the soup. That means I would also like the soup. And that way, I get soup with dinner. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/franken. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/franken, spelled babbel.com/franken. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. With SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5, this foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation, and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself at amazon.com/instant-eraser-foundation.
Some of us, I've been doing this, I guess, 4 years now. Some of us my favorite book that I've done. You're my favorite guest. Yay. Said that many times. And now The Sum of Us is a middle school book. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. And I want to ask you all about that. I want to ask you what you've learned about middle school and what you've learned about public education in America. Mm-hmm. And the book, of course, is that our economy is not a zero-sum game, that whites have been told by other whites that, you know, that anything that helps black people economically hurts them, and how that is just not true. That's the book, right?
Yep.
There's a little deja vu here because the first time we met, you were head of Demos, a think tank, and a lot of what you guys studied was financial regulation, right? Mm-hmm. And there was a banking crisis.
Yes.
A very funny banking crisis. And I just want to get your take on how fast Silicon Valley Bank was bailed out and how fast black homeowners were bailed out in 08.
Well, thanks for asking that, Al. You know, as you know, we met when you were on the banking committee.
I wasn't on banking.
On the banking committee. That's right. You were the most influential person off of the banking committee.
Nevertheless, yes, we met about that. But no, I was not on banking. I don't know that much about banking. So I want to ask you about it because you know about banking. You really do.
I found myself as the co-chair of the Task Force on Systemic Risk and Resolution Authority, basically. How do we make sure that the banks don't fail? And if they do, that taxpayers aren't on the hook within this coalition called Americans for Financial Reform, the sort of pro-reform David to the Wall Street Goliath in the wake of the financial crisis. And what I learned there was a lot of things. And really, the lasting thing I learned was that the power of the financial industry, which has been for most of my lifetime the biggest spender in politics in Washington, is just tremendous. And so in this window when Wall Street greed and racism, as I outline in the book, and I have a whole chapter dedicated to the financial crisis and how black homeowners were the canaries in the coal mine, getting targeted with predatory mortgages first and being ignored until everybody was on the hook and losing out in the peak of the mortgage crisis. Wall Street greed had cost the U.S. economy 8 million jobs, tens of trillions of dollars in lost wealth. And at that moment, when they were sort of on their knees, we were able to win some really common sense regulations. One of those rules was that the biggest Wall Street banks, the ones that would come with their hats in hand again if they ever failed, they needed to be under tighter supervision. They were systemically important financial institutions, and they needed to have more cash and liquidity and capital reserves and all of that. And we won, and we made that threshold $50 billion, which is a heck of a lot of money. And it was, you know, all the most important, biggest banks. And then under Trump, you know, Republicans and with a few Democrats, were able to listen to bank CEOs like the CEO of Silicon Valley Bank, actually, and lots of other sort of what they call mid-size banks who said, oh, these burdens of having to carry all this extra cash and save for the future and be more prudent, they're just killing us. And they won, right? The memories had faded. We had a Republican in the White House. And they were able to get themselves a loophole so that they did not have to have the same safeguards and cash on hand.
This was 18, so they were still in the majority in both houses.
This is 2018. That's right.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Not 5 years later, we have two of those banks, first Silicon Valley Bank and then Signature Bank, which were the exact banks that were lobbying to get out from under the regulations that were basically just, you know, safeguards, now being caught without enough capital reserves, without enough liquidity, and having to come and ask for a bailout. The lesson for me in this is that actually regulations work. Safeguards are smart. This bank was exactly the kind of bank that should have always been under that extra level of scrutiny. And the reason why it failed was that it took a huge outsized risk in one type of security, in one type of bond.
Well, what it did was it bought treasury bonds, right?
Yeah, long-term ones.
Long-term treasury bonds at a point when interest rates were low and they were getting a good yield on the bond, but not for long-term because we have inflation. And then, of course, the Fed raised the rates.
And even though it did look like a good bet, you don't put $117 billion of your $211 billion in asset in one type of security. You just don't do that. They were way, way, way concentrated in one type of security.
It is insane.
It's insane. It makes no sense. And I would like to think that if there were regular stress tests, if there was the capital and liquidity requirements, A, somebody and one of the regulators would have said, you're overbalanced here. And then B, they would have been required to have enough cash on hand to be able to deal with what ended up happening with the bank run.
So when did they realize this? Because it's insane they held on to this stuff, but they had to, I guess. Yeah. How do you sell these treasuries when they're getting a smaller yield than inflation?
Yeah, I mean, it is a problem. And right now, the bailout actually consists of the U.S. government buying those bonds from them. And so the U.S. government can either hold them until they mature for 20 years, basically at a loss, or sell them now at a loss. I mean, basically, it's not a straight bailout in the way that folks sort of imagine, but it is getting those
bad investments. It is. That sounds like a bailout
to
me.
It absolutely is. It absolutely is. It's taking those investments out in order to make the people who kept their money in those accounts in excess of the FDIC insurance, the $250,000, make them whole. And it does matter. I mean, the thing is, like, this is why we need a well-regulated system, because some people are saying, you know, oh, just let the rich startups and tech companies, you know, let them burn, right? Let them go. But Silicon Valley Bank was also a really heavily banking in climate tech, right? So a lot of like community solar and a lot of the clean energy economy that our entire planet desperately needs to succeed had a lot of their funding in these banks and was invested in by this bank. And so, you know, we're interrelated, right? I mean, I do believe that it's important for there to be trust in the financial system. But the way that trust is earned and the way that failures are prevented is by being willing to comply with some regulations and safeguards.
Yeah. Is this going to go south, this thing, this banking crisis, by the way?
You know, I will say that when I was working on financial regulation in the mid-2000s, I knew that there was a housing bubble. I knew that the subprime mortgage industry was a ticking time bomb. I saw it because I saw the homeowners, the whole neighborhoods that had lost everything from a financial instrument that was quickly spreading all across the country out of black and brown neighborhoods into white neighborhoods and becoming an important part of most sophisticated financial instruments. I don't know. Okay. I do not have that same feeling today. I do not have the same feeling that there's something fundamentally rotten at the center of the financial industry today.
Good. We'll leave it there. phew. So the book is out. Now, The Sum of Us is now a middle school book. What does that mean? What does that mean?
So one of the most common things that people said when I was going around the country talking to folks about the grown-up book, as I now refer to it in my house, was this should have been required reading. I wish I knew this stuff earlier. And so I started thinking, well, maybe we could do what's been done increasingly these days with books that do well in an adult version, which is, you know, have a young adult publisher and editor take a chop at it for younger people. And honestly, Al, I thought that it was going to be, you know, a little bit of rewriting, maybe bring some more kind of stories and characters, dumb down the language a little bit.
I know you asked me to illustrate it.
Exactly. As I was talking to librarians and school teachers and this little focus group that I put together of middle schoolers, they were like, just don't dumb it down. It needs to be shorter for kids to actually get through it. And so honestly, it's about a third shorter. It's still got the facts and figures and the history. It's still got the stories of real people that have been so important to making the book kind of different than most books about the economy and racism. And it's just as hard-hitting a message about slavery, about economic and racial segregation.
One of the facts, or one of the things that I did not know that I learned from the book, and I learned stuff like this all throughout the book, was that it was the federal government that invented redlining. That was during the New Deal.
Yep.
And it was FDIC rule. So explain that. And that's something that I didn't know. And I was on the banking committee. Oh, no, I wasn't. Anyway, so.
All this misinformation. It was the Homeowners Loan Corporation that was set up by FDR to rescue homeownership in the Depression and then carried on in the FHA, the Federal Housing Authority. Basically, you know, the New Deal government said, we're going to do this massive commitment to housing in America, that there should be affordable housing for workers, there should be new developments and subdevelopments, and that there should be this thing, this mortgage that will be widely available, low down payment, and it'll be subsidized and it'll be insured and backstopped, and we will create something really unprecedented, which was the idea of mass home ownership by working class people. And yet, the progressive federal government under FDR based all of that policy on the never substantiated assumption that Black people would be too much of a credit risk. And so they sent out surveyors to all of the biggest metro areas in the country and surveyed the neighborhoods to the block level for their racial and ethnic character and designated areas with a high Negro concentration to be hazardous and put red lines around it saying, do not lend in these areas. You would not, as a private lender, get any of the federal support or backstop or insurance if you lent in these areas. And so basically you had whole swaths of the country, because Black people lived there, cut out from the financial engine of the 20th century, which was finance, which was home ownership and small business loaning. What ended up happening is that people had, Black people like my great-grandmother, Flossie McGee, had to buy her property from a loan shark and pay terrible interest rates and not have any recourse. If she ever missed a payment, she would lose the whole thing. And thank God she never did. But I mean, she was a domestic worker and she was able to do that. But it also meant that, you know, whole communities would have a hard time keeping up their properties and investing in, you know, you couldn't get a loan. It made for a financial fragility and a, you know, 20, 30 percentage point lower home ownership rate for Black families. And you still see that, the impact of that today. You see it
absolutely.
You know?
And I brought this up last time we talked, which is Spotlight, which is the Boston Globe investigative wing, did this survey of all the greater Boston area and see the net worth of white families and of Black families. And the net worth of white families is around $250,000. And the net worth of Black families, and this is at the end of the Great Recession, was like zero, was like $12 or something like that. And it's all home ownership.
Yep. It's all home ownership. And if you think about all the other things that are tied to home ownership, and we talk about this when I'm in middle school and high schools and libraries right now for the book tour for the young version of Some of Us, what's tied to home ownership? Property taxes, school funding, right? That's how you begin to see this, you know, this massive disparity in how our schools are funded between majority Black, majority white, majority of color districts, rich and poor. And it becomes even more unconscionable when you realize that today's young people are literally paying in unequal schooling resources for the explicitly racist decisions of the 20th century that we've never had a reckoning about. There's never been any reparations for redlining, right? In fact, the opposite happened with the financial crisis and the systematic discrimination in formerly redlined areas by financial companies that, you know, were later, they got their comeuppance because, you know, you ignore the canary, you get poisoned, right? And yet those Black communities have never been made whole.
We're going to take a quick break now. We'll be right back with Heather McGee.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
We're back with my favorite guest, Heather McGee. Since you have a book that's going to middle schools, you must be learning a lot about our education system and the disparities in schools.
You know, it's been really interesting. I just came this morning before sitting down to talk with you, Al, from my son's school here in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn.
Beautiful boy.
He is a beautiful boy.
I've seen pictures of this kid, and I know you say that to every parent, but here I am. This kid is beautiful. Never mind. Keep going.
Thank you. Inside now. I really do believe it. So I talked to the fifth graders in his school, and it's a neighborhood school, public school in Clinton Hill, Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn. And, you know, it's about 75% Black, probably, I don't know, maybe 15% white. And I've also gone to schools. Last week I was in an all white high school in, you know, the very wealthy part of the mainline sort of suburbs of Philadelphia. I was at a Quaker school. I was at a New England day school in Connecticut. And a few things really stuck out to me. One, there is quality education happening in all kinds of schools. And I think that sometimes, you know, particularly on the left, we're so focused on the inequities that we can sort of cast a big net of underachievement and all of that around brown and Black schools. But my kid's just public school, neighborhood, mostly Black school is one of the top 5% test scoring schools in the state of New York. And so I think it's really important to remember that so it doesn't make us feel that poor kids can't learn, that Black and brown kids can't learn, and that there can't be excellence even in schools.
Okay, but let me ask you, why is the school so good?
I think it's got a great principal. I think it's got a super involved.
That matters.
Who recruits great faculty and keeps them there and supports them. And, you know, it's like a well-functioning organization, right? And I just think it's become a school with a lot of pride and a lot of investment of time and resources and talent from the sort of, you know, middle-class Black community here in the heart of Brooklyn.
Is that important, too, that there's a large middle-class Black population there?
I think so. I think it means education. It means time, right? Mm-hmm. If you're a middle-class person, you have a little, you know, of course, everybody feels completely stressed, but you have a little. I was able to go, right, at 9:30, and there were five other parents this morning who had enough of a professional job that they weren't getting docked hourly pay to come and volunteer and be a part of their kid's school. Those parents are more likely to have paid family leave and be able to take care of their children and to be able to escape the stress of poverty, which we know is really challenging for development of children. And I say that because the $250 a month child tax credit actually in studies helped the brain development of the children in families that got that money as opposed to a control group that got none. You know, I mean, this stuff is really important, and it's about family stress. So I think it's about the health of the community. And I think it's about the resources and not just money, but also time that parents and the community are able to pour into the school.
You know, I'm so thankful to you that you agreed to do the Daily Show when I do that. And I got, now I just wish like I could say the Daily Show. Can we just do Heather? Because it would be so much better. Okay.
We're going to have fun. We're going to have a lot of fun on the Daily Show. I'm so excited for you.
But we got to get this information out, which isn't always fun. But anyway, so in fact, what do we want to talk about beside the book? What we should do is do what we're doing here and talk about how the book dovetails with having this book out in middle schools, which is what we're doing right now. I'm saying what we're doing. You don't usually do that on a podcast.
Let's be very clear. This book, I went to Pennsylvania. Let's see, I went to Connecticut, New York. I was in Texas last week, but I didn't do a school. I did a bookstore. Technically speaking, some crank could challenge this book in Florida and 10 other states and say that it should be a banned book because it talks about systemic racism.
Boy, you know what? It's amazing. You mentioned Florida. It's kind of amazing the governor hasn't banned this or tried to.
You know, what's interesting is here's the sort of nefarious brilliance of what is being done is that the governor didn't put out a list of banned books. The governor and the right-wing state legislature said, you can't teach any books or these books can be challenged if they make a student feel uncomfortable because of their race, you know, if they talk about systemic racism, et cetera, right? And so what they did, though, was they empowered cranks to challenge those books.
Fortunately, very few of those in Florida.
Very few older people with time on their hands who are listening to Fox News all the time in the state of Florida. And so what that's smart organizing, right? Because it decentralizes it. It creates a sort of army of people who can make life hell for librarians in this school, that school, that school. It creates a sort of chaos of small cuts that I think ultimately what this strategy is around the book banning is something to put public schools in further crisis in order to ultimately drain the public pool of public education in America, right? The right wing's goal has always been school privatization, get that huge pot of taxpayer money, put it in a for-profit system, and break the backs of one of the biggest, most sophisticated unions, the teachers' unions. And while you're at it, make sure that young people are not learning to be citizens and live in a multiracial democracy, but rather, you know, can be in sort of Christian academies.
Well, you are a conspiracy theorist. I just thought it was just a racist idea. Let's not teach that there. Let's not make a kid feel uncomfortable. Let teachers have to say, you know, for the first, 250 years in our country, there were a group of people who had to work for free. It's not like your unpaid internship at your dad's law firm. It was very unpleasant work.
Well, that's the thing. My thesis throughout the book is that racism is ultimately a justification for greed. And so you do have to look at what is the economic goal behind the lie of racial caste and the lie of racial subjugation, whether it was to create the most profitable economic system for lazy people in the history of the world, which was chattel slavery, or today to privatize public schools and to scare white parents away from public schools and politically the Democratic Party. There's always a financial rationale.
Well, yeah, that's the message of the book, which is that wealthy whites, especially the upper class whites, have told white working people that anything that helps black people hurts them.
That's right. But the good news is, Al,
good.
I mean, this is a sophisticated book, right? It talks about the financial crisis. It talks about the history of economic slavery. It talks about, you know, social science and zero-sum theory. But you understood it. Fifth graders totally were with me this morning. Sixth, seventh, eighth graders. The questions they are asking are so wonderful and sophisticated.
I want to hear about that. Tell me what these kids are asking when they read the, or when you're presenting about it. What are these kids getting? In other words, and what are the questions they're asking? And because this is sophisticated stuff, but one, you are a very clear explainer of stuff, both in the book and when you're presenting to the kids. But tell me what they're asking and what they get.
So I tell them the story of a 13-year-old boy named Tommy Cummings, who was a Black boy in Baltimore in 1953, who had a crew of friends. He was Black, he had another Black friend, and then there were two white boys. And they were this inseparable crew. They get that. And then I tell them it was hot in the summer, and there were all these pools, but they couldn't swim together in any of the pools. Why? And they're like, oh, because segregation, right? They're staying with me, right? They've got this. It's 1953. They know that there was something called segregation. And I asked them what they would do if they were Tommy and there was no public pool where all the four boys could swim together. And finally, they usually realize that they have to go swim in a river or a lake. And then I tell them that they did that, but that Tommy drowned because it is much more dangerous to swim in a river than it is to swim in a public swimming pool with a lifeguard. You know, they're shocked by this. And then I tell them that the family agitated and marched and was able to win integration of all the public pools so that nobody like Tommy would have to give their life just to swim with all their friends, no matter what color of their skin. And they kind of, you know, they're thrilled. And then I tell them.
That wasn't true?
No, it was true.
Oh.
But that in response, all over the country, towns drained their public pools rather than integrate them.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
And they are shocked. And they get it immediately, right? They say, well, everybody lost out then. Racism is bad for everybody. And then they ask me questions like, who told white people that Black people were bad? Great question, right? Why did they tell? Why did those white people, right? Who first came up with the idea that Black people were bad? So I tell them about the plantation owners and I tell them about racism being an excuse, a justification for greed. We talk about poverty and inequality and I ask them what they think the minimum wage is and they say $15 an hour and I say it's $7.25, right? And they're shocked because they didn't realize that, you know, almost half of the state still have a $7.25 minimum wage.
Well, Brooklyn's expensive, so that's justified in Brooklyn. So I'm going to have to argue with you here.
Nowhere in the
country. I'm arguing with Heather McGee here, explaining why the minimum wage should be $7.50
in Tuscaloosa. Nowhere in the country can a worker afford an apartment for their family on minimum wage, right? So at
right, that's why they have to work more than 40 hours a week, and that the work ethic is good, and why both mom and dad should both be working that time, even if there is a single parent.
That's
there.
Right.
Okay.
So they ask questions.
I'm trying to be a right-wing talk show host here.
For you are. You are. You're very good at it.
I do for about 10 seconds.
Your logic fell apart immediately.
Good.
Because suddenly there was a kid at home alone watching TV.
And what's wrong with that? See, I'm pretty good at this. Shit. Okay, go ahead. Keep going.
They ask questions like, why is it that I tell the story of minimum wage workers organizing to try to win $15 an hour? And they ask questions like, why is it that Bridget, one of the characters I talk about, a real person I interview in the book, why did she believe that immigrants were taking her jobs? Who told her that? They ask questions like
Dr. Carlson.
Exactly, right? So I get to talk about who is selling these stories for their own profit, right? What does somebody gain by getting a white worker to blame their Black or brown neighbor instead of blaming the boss?
Or an immigrant. Yeah.
Exactly. And so they really get it. They really understand the metaphor of the drained pool. You know, I say the most important things in life, can we really fix them on their own? And they say no. And I said, what's an example of something that you can do on your own, but it doesn't really solve the problem? This morning, kid shoots up his hand and says, recycling. It's not going to stop global climate change. I was like, exactly, right? So they really get it. They really get, you know, the main message of the book is about collective action. And then some of them have been following the stories around book bans and, you know, books being taken off the shelves in libraries. And they're just furious. They're just outraged. They think that grown-ups who are trying to stop them from reading books are evil. I mean, they just think, I've been told all my life that that's what I'm supposed to do. And then here are these people trying to take the books out of classrooms and off the library shelves.
And this is a real project of today's right wing.
Absolutely. And I want to say it's not popular. Like, this is actually really important. I think because our media ecosystem is what it is, you have, you know, the usually about 7 out of 10 of the top, you know, most shared sites and stuff on Facebook are right wing. You have Fox News often being the highest cable rated network, all of that. And then you have the rest of us sort of rubbernecking and looking at the car crash that is all of this crazy antisocial authoritarian behavior. And it feels like, oh my God, the right is winning. Book bans are sweeping the nation. We must be 50-50 on this issue. Wrong. 88% of Americans think we have to teach all of our history, the good and the bad. A bunch of librarians did a big survey and found that only 18% of voters support banning books that focus on race. 18%, right? In Florida, the book bans are unpopular with 2/3 of voters, right? So we've really got to make sure that we have the moral high ground about this. Unsurprisingly, the idea of banning books strikes most Americans as fundamentally un-American and suspect, right? They're suspicious of people who want to stop us from learning about ourselves.
Yeah, you wonder, when I see DeSantis doing what he's doing, I wonder if he is just saying, okay, I just got to get the MAGA people. I just got to be acceptable to the MAGA people so I can get this nomination. I'm not saying he's doing that and then I'm going to move to the left, you know, but yeah. There's, God damn, this is pretty evil stuff that I'm seeing coming out of him.
It really is. The takeover of New College, the attack on academic freedom. And what's so wild about it is, remember when the, you know, New York Times, very serious people were wringing their hands about cancel culture on college campuses. The right wing is now literally canceling an entire school, right? Is taking over a public college in Florida, trying to end tenure, creating, putting some ideological partisan hacks in the leadership, you know, dissolving all the student clubs that have to do with race or identity, right? Like, and this is actually the government doing this, right? A bunch of young people protesting a speaker is not a violation of speech, right? The First Amendment protects people from infringements by the government, right? From state power stopping people from speaking. And that's exactly what the right wing is doing right now, using the power of the state to try to stifle free expression. And it's just an amazing example of projection. And still, we have, quote unquote, very serious people in the New York Times editorials publishing articles from young Republicans saying that college campuses are too liberal. And what that does is give moral cover and false equivalence to the actual authoritarian, like, campaign that's happening right now against higher education. And you got to wonder why, right? Like, what's this all about, right? I talked about how at the K-12 level, I think it's fundamentally about school privatization and that big pot of gold that is taxpayer money and being able to privatize schools and create Christian academies and for-profit schools.
And yeah, for-profit charter schools and that kind of thing.
Yeah, all of that, right? And then the higher education conversation, you know, it was about 15 years ago that the right wing really began to turn against college and turn against the university.
What date did you give it?
It was about 15 years ago in our politics. It was, you know, around the sort of sorting around the Obama era. And I
think it was earlier.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, I mean, it was the 60s in some ways. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was Reagan in California kind of ran against Berkeley.
Yeah.
So a lot of it was Vietnam, but a lot of it was, you remember, they had free tuition at all their colleges.
That's right. That's
right. And then they got rid of that.
And I write about that in the book, about how that's drained pool politics as well. But as people become more educated and learn more about our society and have their critical thinking skills developed, they tend to become more tolerant, more open-minded, and yes, more liberal. And so ultimately, it is not in the right-wing self-interest electorally to to have a highly educated populace. It's why they begin to be against refunding public college to make it debt-free, against student loan debt cancellation.
I love the poorly educated. Right. Didn't Trump say that? I love the poorly educated.
That's right.
Well, Jesus loved the poorly educated.
Yeah. Jesus really loved them. He washed their feet. Exactly.
Oh, yeah. Trump's never done that.
Lord. Oh, what a crazy image.
Yeah. Well, Stormy Daniels, maybe she was poor at the time and he washed her feet.
Stop.
Oh, stop it, Al. Take that out, Peter. Now keep it in because I got a good laugh. That's all I care about, as you know.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, boy. So the book is doing, this is middle schools, and you want, and where is it being part of the curriculum now?
The middle school version, middle school and high school version just came out 2 weeks ago. And so it hasn't really made it into curriculums yet. Although today at my son's school, I thought I was just going to be talking to them about it. But the whole front row was fifth graders who had already bought it and were, you know, a third of the way in. It's only been out for 2 weeks. So that is the goal, ultimately. And listen, I believe in radical empathy. And I can understand if I was a white middle-aged person and much of the racial history in the book and the ideas of anti-racism were new to me, I would feel some kind of way about my kid coming home with all this information that I didn't have and thinking critically about the jokes my family makes over the dinner table and the legacy of inherited wealth that my family had that was, you know, subsidized by the government that I didn't realize was subsidized by the government and, you know, all of this stuff, right? And so I do think that there is a way in which I hope a book like mine both opens people's eyes of all races and offers a unifying message to say that racism, it's really not a zero sum. It's not us versus them. And it's in all of our interests to fight against it. There's a lot of false fear about teaching about racism, but there is, I think, some genuine fear among some people that reading about racism further divides young people. And my book is a unifying one and a hopeful one. And
it is.
I hope it doesn't get banned.
Well, your book says we all do better when we all do better.
That's right.
And that dividing us is, I think you had some statistic in your book about McKinsey saying that what it costs us to pit each other against each other.
That's right. McKinsey did a study about the racial wealth divide. The bigger number was even from Citigroup, which found that the black-white economic divide in jobs and businesses and wealth has cost the U.S. economy $16 trillion over the last 20 years. It's basically saying that if black families had the same level of income, wealth, business starts, all of that, that it would be so productive for the economy that the economy would be $16 trillion richer. That having, as I, you know, use the metaphor to explain it, right? If we don't have all of our players on the field scoring points for our team, if we have too many of our players with potential sidelined due to debt, discrimination, disadvantage, we're not going to score enough points. But the zero sum lie tells us that we're not all on the same team. And so you've got people rooting against their fellow teammates, their fellow Americans, being resentful that black people might that black young graduates might receive a $20,000 student loan debt cancellation from the Biden administration. And they have this zero sum arguments that we even heard in the Supreme Court hearing, where one of the Supreme Court justices said, well, why should a small business owner who started a lawn care company be disadvantaged, you know, as opposed to a student borrower? And, you know, first of all, if your small business fails, you can discharge your debt in bankruptcy, which student loans are not eligible for.
Ooh.
Second of all, we had, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars in PPP loans for businesses, which, you know, individual student loan borrowers were not able to get. And so, you know, it's false on its face, but then think about it. What does a lawn care small business owner really want?
Wants people who want their lawns cared for?
Yes. Wants people who can buy homes and have some extra money to pay somebody to mow their damn lawn. And what is the number one reason why young people are not buying homes today?
Because they're in debt.
Exactly.
And then they can't buy a home with a lawn.
So, you know, it's this false idea that if one group gets something, that it has to come at the expense of the other group. And that's not actually the way the economy works.
Be funny if lawn care people were like very much like, we've got to preserve water and we have to do it smart. Otherwise, people won't in the future, they won't be able to have lawns.
Yeah, right.
That would be a very funny interest group. Heather, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on, Al.
It's always you're always so great. And see you soon.
All righty. See you soon.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you, like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail, or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. I'm Guy Raz, and on my show How I Built This, I talk to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt and failure and talk about how they were able to overcome them on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen to Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to The Best One Yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.